This is BOA News by remote. I'm Michael Brown. U.S. President Donald Trump conceded for the first time on Thursday that Joe Biden will be the next president, a day after his supporters stormed the U.S. Capitol as Congress was certifying Biden's victory. Trump, who as recently as Thursday morning continued to claim falsely that the election had been stolen from him, condemned Wednesday's violence, saying rioters had defiled the seat of American democracy, and said his focus would now turn to ensuring a smooth transition. Trump's remarks come after Democrats, the top Democratic leaders, called for his removal from office following Wednesday's assault. President Trump's Transportation Secretary, Elaine Chao, announced her resignation Thursday, the first cabinet secretary to resign because of Wednesday's deadly invasion of the U.S. Capitol by a mob of Trump supporters. Late Thursday, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos became the second cabinet member to resign a day after the violence at the Capitol. She blamed Trump for inflaming tensions. Chao and DeVos joined a growing list of resignations from the Trump administration after hundreds of Trump supporters broke into the Capitol as legislators were in the process of certifying the Electoral College votes in the November election, formalizing President-elect Joe Biden's win. The White House did not immediately comment on the resignations. U.S. law enforcement authorities have opened a criminal investigation into Wednesday's attack at the U.S. Capitol. The acting U.S. Attorney General for the District, Michael Sherman, said 15 people charged in federal court in Washington in connection with the rioting, 40 others charged in D.C. Superior Court leading up to the riot, most of them for unlawful entry to the Capitol grounds. This is VOA News. Continuing with the story pertaining to the Capitol Police, federal charges and the rioters. Federal charges include theft of government property against the rioters. The attack left 4 people dead, dozens wounded. Some of the rioters who stormed the U.S. Capitol were fired from their jobs Thursday after Internet police publicized their identities. The District of Columbia Police Department released photos of people in Wednesday's melee and potential charges against them. The FBI also asked the public to help it identify rioters. Law enforcement officials in charge of protecting the U.S. Capitol repeatedly declined offers of additional assistance ahead of Wednesday's riot, which ended with 4 people dead. A day after the chaos, U.S. Capitol Police, the Associated Press reporting, the police chief Steve Sun submitted his resignation Thursday, and a source with knowledge of the matter told the AP the chief's last day would be January 16th. In a statement earlier in the day on Thursday, Sun defended his officer's actions, but he did not say why he had declined additional manpower and resources. The U.S. state of California recorded more than 1,000 deaths from COVID-19 in a 2-day period Thursday, and the U.S. reported a 1-day record 3,865 Americans deaths Wednesday, according to Johns Hopkins University Coronavirus Resource Center. The grim figures come as nearly 6 million Americans have been vaccinated against the disease. Meanwhile, on Thursday, Britain announced mandatory COVID-19 tests for all international arrivals to the country. Japan's prime minister declared a state of emergency for Tokyo and surrounding areas. The decree takes effect today and lasts until February the 7th. The head of the World Health Organization's European region says a new variant of the coronavirus that emerged in Britain doesn't appear to increase the severity of symptoms, but it does raise alarm for healthcare providers. Dr. Hans Klug says the region is facing a tipping point in the course of the pandemic. He says 22 countries in the region have detected the new variant. Some former Hong Kong legislators and pro-democracy activists were released on bail late Thursday after being arrested under Hong Kong's national security law as part of Wednesday's mass arrest of 53 people. The activists accused of taking part in an unofficial primary election last year that authorities say was part of a plan to paralyze the government and subvert state power. For details on more news, we invite you to join us on our website. That is voanews.com, also on the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, via remote, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Zimbabwe's president joins world leaders in condemning violent pro-Trump protests in Washington, D.C.
The president's position is that the United States of America has lost high moral ground to police and prefect Zimbabwe on how best to achieve democracy, freedom of expression, and human rights observation.
Sudan signs on to the Abraham Accord, normalizing relations with Israel. South Africa announces imminent arrival of 1.5 million COVID-19 vaccine doses as the country records high daily COVID-19 infections. And Uganda's Bobby Wine defends flying his children to the United States ahead of the January 14 election.
Recently, we had very credible information that they were intending to kidnap some of my children in order to coerce me into subjugation, to accept things that I didn't believe in, or to make me say things or make statements that I don't believe in.
And Cameroon says rampaging elephants killed 10 people, leaving many homeless and hungry. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley Sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa on Thursday joined other world leaders in condemning Wednesday's violent pro-Trump supporters' protest in Washington, D.C. In a tweet, President Mnangagwa said the U.S. has no moral right to punish other nations under the guise of democracy. The U.S. and the European Union have imposed sanctions on Zimbabwe over its democracy and human rights record. The U.S. sanctions are under the Zimbabwe Democracy and Economic Recovery Act, also known as ZEDERA, which Congress passed in 2001. President Donald Trump extended the sanctions in 2019. Tafazwa Mugwade is Director of Information for Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party.
The President of the Republic of Zimbabwe believes that whether in the Southern Hemisphere or in the Northern Hemisphere, political, social, and economic differences between different persuasions can be resolved through dialogue. And therefore, he has expressed himself as somebody that has been taken aback by the developments at Capitol Hill, where violence took center stage in an unprecedented set of developments in the history of the United States of America. More so, knowing fully well that the United States of America is a country that is set to prefect and police the government and the people of Zimbabwe in as far as democracy and human rights observation is concerned. And the president's position is that the United States of America has lost high moral ground to police and prefect Zimbabwe on how best to achieve democracy, freedom of expression, and human rights observation.
So it seems that President Mnangagwa has congratulated the U.S. President-elect Joe Biden, and he's looking forward to the removal of the sanctions. What is he willing to show the U.S. President-elect in terms of the issues that led to the imposition of the sanctions, first of all?
If you recall very well, the Republic of Zimbabwe, through its Commander-in-Chief of the Zimbabwe Defense Forces and His Excellency the President of the Republic, Comrade Emmerson Mnangagwa, was one of the first countries and republics and governments to congratulate President-elect Joe Biden. The whole purpose of doing that was to say, we're extending to you an olive branch to smoke the peace pipe. We're a peaceful nation that seeks coexistence on the basis of respect of independence of each republic and sovereign right, and the right to self-determination. And for that matter, the President of the Republic of Zimbabwe expects the relations between the United States of America and Zimbabwe to thaw and warm up on the basis of objective observation of realities on the ground, which realities speak to the ability and commitment of the Second Republic and the new dispensation to political reforms. The commitment of the Second Republic to allowing freedom of expression, the ability and commitment of the Second Republic to freeing the space and opening up the space so that Zimbabweans can enjoy, you know, the fruits of their independence and freedom. And therefore, in return, the successive administration of President Joe Biden should do the right thing, and remove unconditionally the legal sanctions imposed on the people of Zimbabwe and their government.
What do you say to the opposition or human rights groups in Zimbabwe who say that the democratic process in Zimbabwe under President Mnangagwa is no better than under President Mugabe?
The human rights groups in Zimbabwe do not stand for human rights observations. The opposition in Zimbabwe does not cease to represent opposition politics. It represents a foreign agenda to usurp and violently achieve a regime change policy that has been the policy of Washington and the government of Zimbabwe. But the government of Zimbabwe seeks peace. The government of Zimbabwe seeks coexistence. The government of Zimbabwe seeks the creation of harmonious relations with the international community, and it is not hostile to anybody, but it has received hostility in return.
Tafazwa Mugwade is Director of Information for Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. Sudan has officially signed the Abraham Accords, agreeing to normalize relations with Israel. The agreement paves the way for Sudan to relieve its massive debt to the World Bank. Naba Muhyiddin has the story from Khartoum.
Thank you.
The historic signing took place at the U.S. Embassy in Khartoum Wednesday. U.S. Treasury Secretary Stephen Mnuchin signed on behalf of Washington, while Sudanese Minister of Justice Nasraddin Abdul Bari signed on behalf of Khartoum. Afterward, Abdul Bari spoke to reporters. Abdul Bari says they welcome the Israeli and neighboring Arab country rapprochement and the diplomatic ties between Sudan and Israel that Sudan will push for its own benefit and for other countries in the region. He said, "We appreciate Mr. Mnuchin's historical visit, and we hope to strengthen ties between Sudan and the U.S. Mnuchin also made a brief statement.
It's a great honor to be here with you today, and I think we'll have a tremendous impact on the people of Israel and the people of Sudan as they continue to work together on cultural and economic opportunities."
The Abraham Accords are a series of U.S. brokered agreements calling for the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and now Sudan to normalize relations with Israel after decades of broken ties. Sudan agreed to sign the accords in part so the United States would remove the country from its list of state sponsors of terrorism, a designation that has blocked Sudan's access to international loans. Late in December, the U.S. removed Sudan from the list and agreed to give Sudan a $1 billion bridge loan to help it clear its debt to the World Bank. Sudanese economist Walid Al-Noor says Sudan needs this help to rebuild an economy struggling with shortages and inflation. Al-Noor says Sudan will benefit from signing the Abraham Accords and the U.S. bridge loan, as it will allow it to enter to the international banking system and relieve the sovereign debt. It will also allow Sudan to take a $1.5 billion loan from the World Bank annually. This amount will help in relieving the overwhelmed Sudanese economy. Sudan was put on the U.S. state sponsors of terrorism list for giving refuge to Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda leaders in the 1990s. Naba Muhyiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
Ugandan presidential candidate Robert Chakulai, also known as Bobi Wine, is defending a move to fly his children to the United States ahead of the country's January 14 election, saying it's for safety reasons. Catherine Nabi reports from Kampala.
Uganda outlets this week were awash with photos of Bobi Wine's children at Uganda's Entebbe International Airport as they prepared to leave the country. Wine, who is the leading challenger against President Yoweri Museveni in the January 14th election, says there have been a number of threats against his four young children. That includes unknown people trailing them from school ever since he declared his candidacy.
I had to change their schools, but they continued to follow them. I had confined the children at home for the longest time because I originally had information that they were targeting them. Recently, we had very credible information that they were intending to kidnap some of my children in order to coerce me into subjugation, to accept things that I didn't believe in, or to make me say things or make statements that I don't believe in.
He says the threats have intensified over the past 2 months of campaigning, leaving him with no option but to fly them to out of Uganda.
I was advised by various leaders and various elders to get my minor children out of the country for safety, following all these threats of kidnapping my children and harming them physically, I decided to agree with that advice and got the children out of danger.
Government spokesperson Ofwono Pondo has dismissed Wine's claims as old narratives that have previously been used by other opposition political leaders. He says the government and leadership has no track record of harming or killing politicians, their families or opponents. However, Wine and several of his supporters have been arrested and beaten in the past few months. Several supporters have died in protests, and in 2018 he was severely beaten while in police custody. Wine says he and his wife have resolved to stay back and continue agitating for the peace and freedoms within the country. Wine and 10 other candidates are running against Museveni, who has been in office for more than 30 years. His critics and international rights organizations say Museveni's government has become increasingly repressive in the past several years, which the president denies. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butter in Washington. Today is Friday, January 8th. When will Africa get the coveted COVID-19 vaccine? In South Africa, the continent's virus epicenter, the health minister says health workers and vulnerable people will go first, getting vaccines in the next 2 months, with the bulk of the population getting them by the end of 2021. Elsewhere on the continent, officials from the World Health Organization said they are determined that low-income countries also get equitable access. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
A ray of hope for the Rainbow Nation, which over a 24-hour period saw a massive spike in confirmed COVID-19 cases. The vaccine is coming this month. On Thursday, Health Minister William Kize announced that South Africa will receive 1 million vaccine doses by the end of January, and another 500,000 in February, both from the Serum Institute of India. The first doses, he says, will go to health workers. Mkhize acknowledged that South Africa's vaccine acquisition was delayed because the nation was unable to pay for vaccines that were still in development, a tactic used by wealthier nations. But he vowed it will catch up. South Africa's limited budget also led officials to choose the cheapest vaccine option, offered by AstraZeneca.
We will be making sure that we bring the vaccines as quickly as possible into South Africa. By the time we start the vaccination program, we won't be very far different from many countries. We would actually be all in line with most of the countries. So we would like to assure the public that, in fact, we are all on course insofar as this matter is concerned.
That heartening news came after the country, which is Africa's viral hotspot, reported what Nkiza described as a grim milestone, surpassing 20,000 new cases in a 24-hour period. And he says the situation gets worse from there, as the nation enters a second wave that features a new variant of the virus that appears to be spreading much, much faster.
The deaths are already higher than what we ever experienced before. The admissions are already higher than what we experienced before. The new cases on a seven-day average are also already higher than what we experienced before.
South Africa has now seen more than 1.1 million cases since the virus first arrived in March. The National Institute for Communicable Diseases says that 31,368 people have died in South Africa. Once South Africa's health workers are vaccinated, a second round of vaccinations will target 17 million people, including essential workers, teachers, the elderly, and those with other health conditions that put them at higher risk. In the end, Mkhize said, the nation hopes to vaccinate about 40 million people within the year, about 67% of the population. That figure is close to what health experts say is the threshold for herd immunity. How about the rest of the continent? Dr. Kate O'Brien is a WHO's Director of Immunization, Vaccines, and Biologicals. She described the process by which 92 of the world's poorest nations can get access to the vaccine through the COVAX facility, a global initiative of 192 countries that is trying to ensure equitable access.
For countries that can afford it, they're paying for the vaccines that are coming through the COVAX facility. For countries, 92 countries, that are less able to actually purchase these vaccines on their own, from their own domestic funds, there are donor funds that have been provided. We need about $7 billion in order to deliver enough vaccine to these countries through the end of 2021. And the facility has already raised about $6 billion of the $7 billion. So the facility has access to over 2 billion doses of vaccine. And we will start to deliver those vaccines probably by the end of January, and if not, then certainly by early February and mid-February. So that's how countries in Africa and South Asia and other countries around the world, of these 92 that are less able to afford vaccines, are actually going to get vaccine. And laying them out and rolling them out at the same time that high-income countries are rolling out their vaccines.
Dr. O'Brien emphasized that people with HIV, South Africa carries the world's highest burden of that virus, should be vaccinated. But pregnant and breastfeeding women should discuss the vaccine with healthcare providers before making a decision. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
South Africans are now in panic mode after the country recorded a record daily COVID-19 infections of close to 22,000 with over 800 deaths. Analysts say the numbers could rise further as citizens and foreign residents return to the major cities after the festive season. The previous highest number of daily infections in the first wave was just below 14,000. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
It's the first time since the coronavirus arrived in South Africa that the single day infection number exceeded 20,000. The infection figures have nearly doubled in less than a month, coming from an average of 11,000 in December. The surge means South Africa has about 1,150,000 cases, the highest on the African continent. But it is the number of deaths that has caused more worries. Although the Minister of Health, Zweli Mkhize, said the higher number was due to previous deaths that had not been tallied in the Eastern Cape province, South Africans are worried, with deaths now nearly 32,000. Johannesburg resident Grace Zwane says the fact that the shocking figures are coming out before many people who had gone away for the festive season return home is an indication that the worst is yet to come.
It is such a sad thing to watch. People disregarded all the restrictions and the regulations put in place to protect us and to safeguard us. And now we are going to pay the price. And this is going to see many businesses. It's either closing down or reducing their staff. Many people are going to lose their jobs.
For some, the worry is about how the figures will look like when workers start returning to their jobs mid-month and when schools open. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Rampaging elephants have killed at least 10 people, destroyed plantations, and left hundreds homeless on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria. The government of the Central African state says people have moved into the elephant's habitat, sparking conflict. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Scores of villagers watch and shout as over 100 elephants trample millet farms in the suburbs of Cameroon's northern town of Kaili. Durugan Musa, a community leader in Kaili, says the elephants have been destroying farmlands and houses in the area since November. No one should attack and provoke the elephants to get wilder, Musa tells 15 male farmers gathered in front of him. He says the lives of humans are more important than the crops and houses destroyed by the elephants. Jean-David Ndigba, the top wildlife government official in the far north region of Cameroon, where Kaili is found, says the elephants have killed at least 10 people within the past 2 weeks. Some died in stampedes. Others were killed when they charged at the animals to scare them away. Officials say the elephants have destroyed more than 100 hectares of millet farms along the northern border with Nigeria. Hundreds of people have been left homeless or hungry. Njigba says the elephants are leaving the Kalfu Reserve in search of water and food. He says the number of elephants in the reserve has increased over time, but the habitat of the animals has been reduced as people take over the land for farms and villages.
La réserve de Kalfu, qui a une superficie d'autres 10,000 hectares.
He says the Kalfu Reserve, which is about 10,000 hectares, was home to 50 elephants 20 to 30 years ago. He says today, the reserve is now down to 4,000 hectares and is the habitat of over 300 elephants. Njigba adds it is dangerous for villagers to try to kill the animals and calls for less confrontational methods to scare the elephants from farms and villages.
On a l'utilisation des tambours, des assiettes, les bidons.
Villagers should make noise, he says, by shouting and beating drums, dishes and pots with sticks to chase the elephants away instead of struggling to kill the gigantic animals. He says villagers can also burn pepper because elephants hate the smell of the spicy hot powder. He says bee farmers should place their beehives on the surroundings of villages because elephants run away from bees. Cameroon is home to an estimated 6,500 elephants, one of the largest populations left in Africa. Wildlife groups have been urging Cameroonians not to kill the animals, which have been poached extensively across the continent in recent decades and are classified as an endangered species. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports with the CAF Champions League. The defending champions, Al Ahly of Egypt, Tunisia's Osporons, TP Mazembe from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and Wydad Casablanca from Morocco will be the top seeds for today's African Champions League draw. The 16 teams who have qualified for the group phase will be divided into four groups of four, with each one drawn from each of the four different ports when the draw is conducted at the Confederation of African Football's headquarters in Cairo. Last season's runners-up, Zamalek, and South Africa's Mamelodi Sundowns will be among the second seeds, and it presents the mouth-watering prospect that Al Ahly will be pitted in the same group as Sundowns, putting the defending champions coach Pitso Mosimane up against his former club. Champions League newcomers Kaizer Chiefs, who won away in Angola on Tuesday to secure their place, are among the bottom seeds. There are eight former winners in the field for this season's Champions League, which will be played over six rounds from February through to April. Staying with the CAF Champions League, three-time former champions Raja Casablanca of Morocco were knocked out of the CAF Champions League by debutant Tenguigueth of Senegal in the biggest CAF Champions League last 32 shock. Both legs in the elite African club competition finished 0-0, and Tenguigueth won 3-1 on penalties in Casablanca to become the first qualifiers for the group phase from Senegal in 17 years. Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa reached the mini league stage for the first time thanks to a 1-0 away win over Primeiro Agosto. There will be no Nigerian club in the group's draw on Friday after a hoped-for second-leg comeback by Enyimba against El Merrikh of Sudan floundered away after only 7 minutes in the southeastern town of Aba. Away from the CAF Champions League now, Nigeria's Golden Eaglets started their campaign at the WAFOB tournament on a losing note, going down 1-0 against Cote d'Ivoire at the Stade Municipal in Lomé. Eaglets needed a win in their final Group B crunchy clash with Black Stars of Ghana on Saturday to stand any chance of progressing to the semi-final. Staying with football news, Tunisia's National Olympic Committee has banned president of the country's football federation, Wadi Jari, for 4 years. In the statement, the committee said Jari had breached national and international Olympic ethics codes. According to the Olympic body, it will be forwarding any complaints against Jari to both the International Olympic Committee and FIFA. In boxing news, Tanzanian professional boxer Hamisi Maya is expected to face Alvin Omondi in an international non-title fight in Dar es Salaam on April the 2nd. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. That's it for this Friday, January 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.